studying this week, Job, was just another now it's going to give me fits. Give me 1 second here.
Working back there, but for some reason I got it up on the screen, but the blank screen from the remote won't work. I wonder if can you go back and see while I work on the class?
Yeah.
The remote's working.
Okay.
But for whatever reason the blank screen.
This one won't turn on.
No.
But it's showing the videos.
Yeah. Okay, we've got to just get into this. Sorry about that. I have no idea why it's not working there. If nothing else, as we look at the book of Job, maybe let me try one more thing here. I'm trying to look for the mute button. Yeah, it's what I keep pressing there. For whatever reason, it won't. Yeah, see, I can get it up here. Okay. If nothing else, as we look at Job, Job is just another reminder for me, and I think for all of us, that the world has been a mess, and it has been for a long time. Hey, there it goes. Okay, so yeah, leave it to a woman, my wife, my wonderful wife, that the world is a mess, and it has been for a long time. Job reminds us of that, as we know, the devil's playground or Satan's stomping ground. I was thinking of the early part of Job. When you look at chapter 1, verse 7, you look at chapter 2, verse 2, when there's that interaction with Satan and God, and the Lord says, said to Satan, "From where do you come from?" And Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming about on the earth." That's his playground, going to and fro or around about it, he told Job. Now, remember in Peter said, be on the alert, right? Your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion. Well, we know where he prowls. He prowls here in this world like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Now, I was looking for a verse, and I wanted to look at it quickly, and I couldn't get on my computer, so I asked Siri. Everybody knows who Siri is? If you don't, on your phone, you can hold the button down on certain cell phones, iPhones, and Siri is basically a person. You can use any voice. Siri is a woman in my case, so on my phone. So I asked Siri, where is the verse talks about the God of this world? And Siri said, I suggest that you direct your spiritual questions to someone more qualified, ideally a human. So I took Siri's advice and found the verse. I knew kind of where it was at, but I just decided to ask Siri. But if you look at 2 Corinthians real quick, Paul will write, when he's talking about the gospel being veiled or covered, and it is covered to those that do not believe in it, that do not believe in Jesus. And in chapter 4 and verse verse 3, Paul will say, "And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing, in whose case, notice, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelieving so that they might not see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." So the God of this world, I remember at my first work in Walsenburg, there was a gentleman there, and he was trying to convince me that Satan was not the God of this world. And took him to 2 Corinthians right here where Paul says, he is the God of this world. That doesn't mean that he has more control than God does, but he is called by the Spirit here the God of this world. And we understand the world, as John says it in 1 John 2:16 and 17, the lust of the flesh, the eyes, and the pride of life. Those things that John says are passing away. And so Satan does roam here. This is his world. I'm taking this off. This is his world, and he's doing everything he can to wreak havoc, as we see in the book of Job. Now, in chapter 3 of Job, remember, we have all the sufferings have taken place. And then we have in chapter 3, Job chapter 3, we have his lament. And some will say, you know what? Jeremiah's lament isn't even close to Job's lament. I mean, Job is pouring out his heart because of all that he is facing. Now, McGuigan, what's happening now?
It's got a mind of its own.
Okay.
It's updating. You
want to
turn it off for a minute?
This off?
Yeah, just so it's not distracting. And I'll let you know when.
Okay. So, McGuigan said, and I want to share a few things from McGuigan, because I think that he does a really good job. He says it so much better than I can say it. But he said it reminds us that everything isn't all right. There is something to grieve about and something we shouldn't be reconciled to, something we shouldn't settle for. So Job laments and his friends have made things worse for him. McGuigan continues on. Speaking to this light, he says, "It's for us to recognize Job's speech for what it is. But if we're enjoying life in the sunshine," and I'm going to add to what McGuigan means, everything is shiny, everything is prosperous as Job's was prior to his suffering, everything shiny and prosperous and in order, we need to be gentle in our judgments. Wouldn't you all agree? When everything is okay in my life, it's easy for me to make my judgments and beliefs and all these things, kind of like Job's friends. But McGuigan did a good job by saying, I think that's what Job wanted his friends to be there for him. They were not gentle in their judgments. One other little section on McGuigan's material that I just couldn't pass up because he says it so perfectly. Let me just read this to you. And this is, you can get this book online if you're interested. Life on the Ash Heap. Job fights God's battle for him. Part of the reason deeply devoted men and women complain about the state of the world is because their God has led them to believe there's more. They wouldn't speak so plainly or complain so loudly if God wasn't the God that they think he is. But it is God who gave them the words of lament. It is God who led and leads them to expect that there's more. He enables them to see the world not only for what it is, but also for what it could and should be. So the laments, the depressing chapters, and even the vile speech bear witness to a planet in rebellion, a planet under judgment and out of tune, but on its way to full harmony. But God can't wipe all this pain and torment out with just an exercise of his will. That's a question he has. The creator of the universe, who has shown his unfathomable love for us in Jesus Christ, has the mechanical power to do what he wishes. But maybe there's more involved than we know. A little magic from God and we'd have an entirely different universe. But would it be the universe He wants? Would it be the universe we in our better moments would want? Would people be morally transformed or robots? Would they choose to live in love with each other or be policed by God every second of their lives? Would it be the universe God is in the process of making this one into, in which dwells heartfelt righteousness? Why, in the meantime, must things continue as they are? I think we'll only get a fully satisfying answer to the why when we are able to see the completed picture. We can't make much sense of only a little fragment of an entire manuscript. But if we were to see the whole story, the little fragment would make perfect sense. Until the entire manuscript appears, the fragments will continue to generate unanswered and unanswerable questions. But the fragment will testify to the existence of the complete story. No one in his right mind would suggest that God, like some divine hitman, simply targets millions of babies and afflicts them with terrible diseases just to have another teaching tool. But it's true just the same that the presence among us of sick and helpless babies, retarded children, defenseless aged, points believers to a larger picture. And in the story of Job, the very existence of the ash heap with a disfigured and raging little man shaking his fist against heaven reminds us that something of galactic significance was taking place beyond the stars. I think McGuigan really sums it up well there. So we've wrapped up. We're going to be able to get this to work, Kelly?
What?
We won't be able to get this to work, will we?
No.
Let's just forget it.
Updated for a really long time.
Okay. So we wrapped up last week with the illustrations from Job. How do we communicate when we want to get our point across as Job did? Well, one way is you throw out these illustrations. You paint this picture. Remember, there was the sandbag picture. There was all kinds of pictures. And basically what Job's friends were saying throughout this whole, their interaction with Job was that, Job, your complaining isn't justified. But on the other hand, Job is saying, his argument is, yes, my complaining is justified. There is reason for my complaining. And we shared some of those last week as we looked. Remember, he brought up the idea that only God can handle this. Remember the sandbag illustration. If you had all the sand on the seashore on your back, would you complain? Nobody can carry this but God. He's going through more. The punishment doesn't fit the crime. If Job has a crime, which he says he doesn't, there's nothing he's done wrong. What he's going through is not right. Only God could deal with this. He also brought up that it's only natural to complain going through what he went through because God has placed that words in him to complain. Remember the ox lowing over its fodder or mooing over its food, right? That's an argument Job is making. Listen, just as an ox moves before it eats, hey, when we're suffering like this, we're going to complain. God made us this way. And so also he brings out his friends. He brings out them and turns it back on them by saying, another reason why I'm justified to complain is because you're my friends. Remember, he called them sorry comforters. They're terrible comforters. They didn't do a very good job. And my favorite illustration that Job used to describe them was when he called them a wadi. We looked at the wadi. Remember what a wadi was? Think of a flood, a river flooding. See, a wadi in the wet season overflows. So do you need any more water when the banks? So there's already water. It's the wet season. You don't need more. But in the dry season, it's bone dry. There's nothing there. It's like a desert. And so Job will bring this up to them. Look at chapter 6 real quick. Basically, what is Job calling his friends? Fair-weathered friends, right? You're good when my life was good, but now that I really need you, you're no good. You aren't offering me anything. Matter of fact, you're making my life worse. Verse 14, he says, "For the despairing man, there should be kindness from his friends." Amen to that. "So that he does not forsake the fear of the Almighty." Verse 15, "My brothers have acted deceitfully like a wadi, like the torrents of wadis which vanish, which are turbid because of the ice and into which the snow melts. When they become waterless, they are silent. When it is hot, they vanish from their place." We'll go down to verse 20. "The paths of their course wind along. They go up into nothing and perish. The caravans of Tema looked. The travelers of Sheba hoped for them." So travelers, think of the travelers, the caravans in the hot desert. There were places that they looked forward to. It's dry. They thirst. They need water. "And the travelers of Sheba had hoped for them. They were disappointed, for they had trusted. They came there and they were confounded." And so he uses this to describe his friends. Let's look at chapter 7. Any comments at this point as we move along? I'm going kind of quick. We got a late start. So chapter 7, verses 11 through 20. Basically, in this section, chapter 7, what we're going to read is Job basically says to God, "Would you just leave me alone? I'm just a man. Why are you messing with me? You're up here, we're down here. Just leave me alone." That's in a nutshell what Job is saying. Notice verse 11. "Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? If I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me by vision." So apparently Job had problems even in his sleep with his dreams. There was no rest for Job. "So that my soul would choose suffocation, death rather than my pains. I waste away. I will not live forever. Leave me alone." Anybody translation say anything different there? Job's asking God to leave me alone. "What do you want to do? What do you want with me? For my days are but a breath. What is man that you magnify him and that you are concerned about him, that you examine him every morning and try him every moment? Will you ever turn your gaze away from me, nor leave me alone until I swallow my spit? I don't even have a break. Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men?" Now, what I find refreshing here in this section is there's insight, I think, into Job's relationship again with God. Remember we said in the beginning, what we find about Job's relationship with God, it wasn't always consistent. It's not on this level plane all the time. We see this up and down person in his relationship, just like us. That gives us some comfort there. But I find it refreshing in Job's relationship with God that he would level with God, that he would be honest with God, that he would speak from his heart to God. That speaks, I think, to his relationship there. Someone said, "God is certainly more complex than the creation. We have to let God be God and then respond accordingly. Our response must be a faith believing that he has a reason and a plan, even if we cannot figure it out." Job can't figure it out. But there is a reason and a plan. Ron had his hand up back there.
I was just going to say, notice the whole attitude a little bit has changed since the beginning. If you see, we would feel the same way, but if you go back to like Job 1:21, he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord will take it away. Blessed be the name of the Lord."
Mm-hmm.
Here in 7, you can see how it's wearing on.
Yes. Yeah.
It's wearing big time.
Yeah. I think it really hit him when his friends came along.
Yeah, but you read what we just read and stopped in here, and it's starting.
Yeah. We stressed in the beginning, like I was saying, that you see this man who wasn't just in his relationship with God, it wasn't always consistent. There were the ups and downs, and you really see that, the down right now with Job. Anybody else want to comment on that? While you're thinking, what are some of the differences between Job's ideas and his friends' ideas that we've seen? In the beginning, we've noted that Job and his friends actually agreed, right? They had the same idea about God, that the righteous prosper and the wicked suffer. That was straight across the board from Job and his friends. But what were there other, that God causes evil, the evil to suffer and the righteous to prosper? That's what his friends are saying to him. That's why Job is confused. Because Job knows in his heart, his conscience is clear. He hasn't done anything. Dave?
Well, one of the questions that he asks here opens up his willingness to say, you know, because there in verse 20, have I sinned? It's like, what have I done?
Yeah.
Maybe there's something I've done. I don't realize I've done something wrong. He's finally to that. Maybe finally to that point. You know, what have I done that you're treating me this way? Again, as we've talked about here in class, you know, we don't know how much the people of that time in that area knew of the existence of an evil one,
mm-hmm.
of a God of this world. You know, again, we have the whole picture right here, starting from the very beginning.
Yes.
That there was.
Behind the scenes, what was going? Yeah,
there was a challenge almost from God to Satan, saying, "Look at Job. You know, he's upright. He's blameless. You know, those types of things." And he comes, and so then God allows Satan to do these things to Job. Job doesn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
We know that.
Yeah.
Job doesn't know that.
Yes.
And so that was part of what Job is struggling with, and because of the mindset, as you just said, wealthy get, you know, the prosperous are that way because they're being blessed by God,
mm-hmm.
or conversely, good people who obey God prosper. Bad people who disobey God,
yeah.
punish. So Job's going like, so why am I being punished? You know. So again, at this point, he's like, okay, maybe there is something I've done that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, it's a good point. Rob?
I've got a question for you. All of Job's friends, were they judging him or were they trying to help him?
It's a good question. Were Job's friends trying to help him or judging him or both? I'd say there's both in there. I think they were sincere. I mean, look at their first, when they first arrive on the scene. They're really good, like we brought out at first, because they don't say anything, right? They're silent. They're grieving with Job. But as soon as they start talking, that's when more and more confusion starts to take place. That's a good question, though. One to really think about.
Well, in chapter 8, Bildad goes on to say that you've done something, and I think it's right away. He says, whatever you've done, you need to turn.
Yeah.
So he's making a judgment. He said, hey, you've done something.
Yeah. Turn back to God and he'll heal you, basically. And he wasn't the only one that said that, really. All of them said it just in a different package, did a little bit differently. Good. Anybody else? So Job is basically saying God is not acting like God is supposed to act, or else I would be prospering, but instead I'm suffering. I should still be living as I was because I'm a good man, right? But Dave does bring out a very good observation of the limited understanding of Job.
Do you think maybe Job's friends, sort of to a point, thought the same way that the devil did? Did Job had everything kind of handed to him and had a hedge around him?
Oh, God had the nice hedge protecting him, making all these blessings for him. I don't know. I don't know that. Possibly. Now look at you. It's been taken from you. Where's your God kind of thing?
Yeah. That
could be.
He didn't have any right to blame, though God had
that that could be. Now, while we're good comments, while we're, think about us today. In a lot of ways, I'm no different in what my first reaction when something really bad happens. Often we've heard it, we've even heard it amongst our own Christian family, the things that we'll say at times when, you know, there's all kinds of things we can look at. God wouldn't let a good man's house burn down. Well, that's not true. We know that. But we might ask questions. You know, I was thinking back when I was working through this point to when most of you remember that Leighton Haggard, the little six-month-old boy years ago that was killed, and we were part of helping that family out. Questions you ask at a time like that. How could God possibly let something like this happen? Matter of fact, there's someone not too long ago after a sermon, it's nobody that's in here, but they came up to me and they said, one of the questions I have for God is, he was speaking of the Holocaust, and we know how terrible the Holocaust was. It's unheard of, the evil that took place there. And he asked me the question, and of course it's not a question that I can give a good answer to. And I can say sin and that's why the world, but that doesn't suffice for those problems. It doesn't soothe our lives, because we say, well, that's because man sinned against God that all this stuff happened. But one of the things he brought out was the question, why God would allow that to happen to all those people. Yet if he intervenes with one, is he going to intervene with all the bad things that happen in life? So all those questions surface at a time like this. God wouldn't possibly allow a Christian man to take his own life or a woman to take their life, leaving family behind. God wouldn't possibly allow evil men to fly airplanes into a building full of people who haven't done anything wrong. I mean, we can go on and on and on with this. God wouldn't possibly allow good intentioned people to be lost on the day of judgment. But we all know that if we don't do the will of God, if we don't come to Jesus and live our life for Him, there's no hope whether we're good intentioned or not. Good intentions don't do anything. Sincerity doesn't do anything.
The problem is God gave us a mind and the ability to think and choose for ourselves.
Yes.
And from the beginning of time, we have made the wrong choices.
That just is a reminder each thing how far we can get. And God allows us to go our own way. Paul will say that in Romans, right? If we're going to rebel against God and we continue to go the way we want to go, God gives us over to those things. He gave the Gentiles over to believe those lies, the delusions. And where does that lead? Far, 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 far away from God, to do the things that are not pleasing to God. Right? So, good. Rob?
You know, if you take a look at Joseph and Daniel both, the things that they were thrown into before,
Very good. Very good. All this raises, I think, questions about God, and I think Job, the book, does, at least for me. And one of those questions is, could God be different from my concept of Him? And I would say at some level, He is different than our concept of Him. I will say at least mine. I'm not going to say that I have a complete concept of it, this eternal being that has created the universe and is still working here to make things the way that He wants them to be. Dave.
I mean, Genesis 1, you know, God says, let us make man in our image. And so often, I think people want to make God in man's image, that God is limited.
Yeah.
You see what Isaiah, you know, my thoughts are higher than your thoughts.
My way is higher than your ways. Yeah. Yeah, good.
So really the basic scenario of Job is what happens when your experience contradicts your theological beliefs.
Mm.
You know, maybe we do need to change our perception of God, that we don't have a very complete understanding, that suffering can sometimes do that for us.
And it did for Job. That's one of the things we see that Job learned. And I think that's really the heart. For me, that's the heart of Job. If there's a central idea that is brought out, can a man still live for God, obey God, if there is every reason in his life not to live for him? Or that we think there's reason not to because things aren't going the way we think they should go, i.e. Job, right? Anything else? Anybody else have any comments? Now, Job will say, let's close with this. And I really apologize about the PowerPoint. I have no idea. It's already. I don't know what's wrong with the computer. I hope we can get it before my sermon. Otherwise, you're going to have to look at me again without the screen up there.
It's a computer. That's
a computer, right? Chapter 9. Chapter 9 real quick, and we're going to close with this. And eventually we see, as Job brings out all this, Job wants to meet with God. Some writers or scholars will say Job wants to take him to court, right? He wants to sit on the stand and argue his case. He's doing that because he believes he really has reason to. And God's going to give him that opportunity. God can handle all this. He knew all along, right? He's big enough to handle all of Job's comments. But he does believe that it's unjust. Chapter 9, verse 17 through 19. And then we're going to close with this. Speaking of God, he says, he bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds. What does it say there? For no reason. Without cause. God is doing this, and there is no reason for it. He will not allow me to get my breath, but saturates me with bitterness. If it is a matter of power, I love this verse. This would make a good sermon. If it is a matter of power, behold, he is the strong one. And if it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Now, Job's going to summon him. Job's going to get that opportunity, right? He's going to have the opportunity to speak with God, and we're going to get to that here shortly. Let's stop there. I think this is a good place to end. Anybody have anything you want to add? Any questions, comments? All right, we're dismissed.